talking about stages of grief. Many of you probably heard about the stages of grief. How many in here have heard about that? Or the tasks of grief or the tasks of mourning. We're not doing that today. Because I think what happens when we try to make sense of something as big and as powerful as grief, we try to oversimplify it. And we try to put order to it, and we try to put reason to it, and we try to make it lovely and predictable and simple. And it's not. And so what I don't want to do is kind of try to give you a false assumption that you're going to listen to this talk, you're going to hear a few words, and you're going to know exactly what to do and exactly what to expect when someone you care about is grieving. So it's not going to be a prescriptive plan. I'm going to give you some ideas and some things to think about and some probably some tips for how to interact with folks who are grieving, but there's no step-by-step plan here. The goal here is to really help you understand enough about the grief process so that you can simply show up and you can be next to that person who's grieving. One thing that we are really good at, we are really, really good at showing up for joyous occasions. Weddings are packed, right? New baby is born. People roll in with food, with meals, with clothes, right? Graduations, right? We attend these and we enjoy them, and we are there for the joyous occasions. And then we see pain. And when pain shows up, we say, ooh, wait a minute. I want to support, but I'm not good at pain. In our culture, we're not good with pain. We tend to run away from it. And if we do show up, we say, I'm so nervous and I don't know what to do with it. And we kind of walk into that situation a little bit blind. And we struggle to just be in the pain like we would just be in the joy. So I hope that you're going to learn enough today about the grieving process that you just feel better able to just sit next to and walk alongside of a loved one as they grieve. If you are grieving yourself, my hope is that this talk will normalize your experience. And my hope is that the more that you learn about kind of the nuances of grief, the more kindness and grace and compassion you will have for yourself as you walk along that journey. That being said, people who are here, I know that people are in various stages of the grief process. Some people have been in grief for many, many, many years. Some people have fresh grief. So please, throughout this talk, do what you need to do to take care of yourself. There's no expectation that everybody in this room has to sit through this entire talk. There's no expectation that you have to be here present for every moment. If there is something that you need to do to take care of yourself, as I talk and as Susie shares her wonderful story of her own grief journey, please do that. There's no judgment here. Do what you need to do. Okay, so one of the things that you're going to hear a lot today is what I'm calling the shipwreck metaphor. So when I was, you know, starting to create this talk on grief, I was going online, and I actually knew what I was searching for because I had read about this before. There is a wise online, if you search it, you literally search old man shipwreck metaphor, and it comes up, which is kind of, I feel bad for this person that he's now labeled as the old man. But he did not sign his name to his advice. But what had happened was there was a young man who was experienced a pretty significant loss. And so he went on, I think, basically to a message board. And he said, how do I do this thing that's called grief? How do I get through this? I need advice, right? I am lost. And so this older man who has been through the grieving process, he provided this wonderful advice to this younger man. And so he said it far better than I will ever be able to say it. So I'm going to use his words today. Okay? And his words come in two parts. So I'm going to start with the first part. We're going to kind of use this to talk about how we walk alongside somebody in more of the early stages of grief. That's what we're going to focus on today is the early stages, because I only have about 45 minutes, and if we did all of it, well, forget it. We're going to be here all weekend, right? So we're going to focus on the earlier stages. At the end, though, we're going to come back to the rest of his story as we kind of move through the later stages of grief. So we're going to start with just at the beginning, his words, to just describe grief. So what he says is, as for grief, you'll find it comes in waves. When the ship is first wrecked, you're drowning, with wreckage all around you. Everything floating around you reminds you of the beauty and the magnificence of the ship that was and is no more. And all you can do is float. You find some piece of the wreckage, and you hang on for a while. Maybe it's some physical thing. Maybe it's a happy memory or a photograph. Maybe it's a person who is also floating. For a while, all you can do is float and stay alive. In the beginning, the waves are 100 feet tall, and they crash over you without mercy. They come 10 seconds apart, and they don't even give you time to catch your breath. All you can do is hang on and float. And so what we're going to talk about today is how can you, as the person who is supporting somebody who is grieving, how can you float with them? Right? You are not going to stop those waves. You cannot. You don't have the power to do that. How can you show up right next to them and hang on? How can you also maybe take some breaks when needed? And how can you maybe understand some of those waves that are coming at that person so that you don't feel like you have to run away while they're experiencing their pain? Okay. So that is early grief. The interesting thing about early grief is that early grief is at minimum a year. Okay. A lot of times when we talk about grief, and I've heard people say this, oh yeah, grief lasts about a year, and then you're back at it. No, okay? Early acute grief is at least a year, maybe a few, okay? This is an ongoing kind of thing. An assumption that grief is just going to end one day is an assumption. It's an assumption that causes harm to the people who are grieving. So when we're talking about early grief, this is not the first week or month. You know, it might be the first 2 or 3 years, and this is where this person might be at and some of the things that they're struggling with for an extended period of time. So that's the piece that we're going to focus on. Okay. So what is grief, right? So we have to, you know, I used to teach, so I have to throw definitions in somewhere, right? So if we're going to just straightupdictionary.com, grief is keen mental suffering or distress over affliction or loss, sharp sorrow, painful regret. It's a lot of adjectives that are pretty intense. So I actually think that definition is actually a really, really good one. It highlights grief is a powerful, powerful thing. And like Kathy said, it's not just reserved for death, okay? It can be the loss of a job. It can be moving away, like she said. It can be the loss of functioning. It can be the loss of what might have been. This is what I hoped for, and now that's not a possibility for me. You can grieve that, even something that you never had but you hoped for. It can be about the loss of relationships. It can be tied into traumatic experiences. So grief it's pretty widespread. We are all going to experience grief at some point in our lives. That's just the nature of the beast. Grief, though, it's not all the same. Okay? And I think sometimes we do it a disservice when we say, well, I'm grieving this and you're grieving that. It's all the same. It's not. Right? Mm-hmm. Grief can vary in severity, and it can be much more traumatic and difficult for in one situation and for one person than for another. So we're not going to just try to, you know, say across the board, grief is grief, and it always looks the same. It doesn't. It rarely looks the same. Grief is not a task to complete. It is something that is ongoing. So you can't just put in your time with grief and expect it to be done. Say, all right, I'm willing to give you 6 months, I'm willing to give you a year, and then I'm ready to be done with this, and I'm ready to move on. Grief is not like that. It is ongoing, and it will be with you. It looks different as time goes on, but it's there still as time goes on. It's not going to be done magically one day. And then I think the most powerful thing when it comes to grief is that grief is not, it's not a problem that we need to solve. It is a normal, healthy human reaction to loss. Grief is born from love. If we didn't love, we wouldn't grieve. Okay? So when we start to look at grief as an extension of love, all of a sudden, when we're supporting somebody, we don't have to fight grief so much. We don't have to say, get rid of it, right? The harder we love, the reality is the harder that we grieve. That's kind of the scary part for a lot of people who are grieving because, ooh, and we're going to talk about this later, but, oh my gosh, I don't know if I want to love so much anymore. I don't know if I want to hope so much anymore because it's so painful when the person or the hope that I had is gone. What do I do with this love? well, now it's grief, right? And how do we walk through that piece of it? So I don't want to talk about grief if it's a bad thing. I want you all, as you're kind of walking through it, to respect it and to value it for what it is, which is just kind of love's next step. Okay. Again, if we go back to our old man, one of the things that he wrote as he was talking to this young man, when he was talking about grief and being connected to love, he said, "My scars are a testament to the love and the relationship that I had for and with that person. And if the scar is deep, so was the love." So we're trying to avoid pain as human beings. We like to try to avoid pain and pull away. But one of the things that we have to know is that if we love deeply, we also grieve and hurt deeply. The nature of love. So, part of why we don't have really good information out there on grief is because even professionals in my field, we don't really fully understand grief. I think one of the issues when it comes to understanding grief is my field of psychology, the field of mental health, we're focused on treating disorders. Right? We're focused on treating problems. Grief is not a disorder. It's not a problem. It's a healthy human reaction. And so when we do all these studies on people who are grieving and the grief process, we're walking into it with an incorrect assumption that this is a problem and I'm only trying to understand this because I'm trying to fix it. We're not going to fix it, right? So if you're walking into studying something with that frame of reference, you're missing half the picture. You're missing kind of that raw, complex, beautiful, and painful nature of grief. So I think professionals don't understand it very well because we're focused on treating it rather than just partnering with somebody, okay? And we want to make it simple. We want to make it predictable. We want to boil it down to 5 steps. It doesn't work, right? Because it's not just 5 steps, okay? The other reason that we kind of struggle and we don't understand grief all that well is because many people don't like to talk about grief because it's painful. We don't want to talk about difficult stuff, right? We tend to run away from the difficult stuff. So when we're looking at somebody who wants to learn more about grief, well, I'm nervous. I don't know that I want to talk to this person about their grief because maybe they're having a good day. I don't want to ruin their day. I don't want to make them upset. I don't want to ask them this question. Right? The person who's grieving, maybe as time goes on, says, you know what? I bet people are sick of hearing about this. I bet they don't want to hear about this. They're having a great day. I don't want to ruin their day. So I don't want to now share everything that's going on with me. And we end up kind of having this culture of silence around grief. We give people a whopping 3 days off of work for bereavement. Whoa, a lot's going to happen in 3 days. But that's the culture that we're in. Yeah, be sad. Feel pain, get over it, and move on, right? And then we wonder why people get stuck, and we wonder why we don't understand it. We don't communicate about it, and we don't study it, and we don't look at it in really kind of meaningful, helpful ways. So, right, when we or when somebody that we love experiences grief, we go into the situation blind. And when we go into a situation blind, we do a heck of a lot of judging. Is this right or is this wrong? I don't know what's supposed to happen. I don't know what's supposed to be. So you're constantly coming in with this question. And you're never, for lack of a better word, you're never comfortable in the pain and in that grief. Because I don't know, should I do something different? Is this normal? Is this not normal? Do I have to change it? Can I be with it? Is it a problem? Should I encourage this? Should I not encourage this? And we walk in and we just get kind of stuck. And so today what I really want to have happen is for you to kind of understand some of the less well-known aspects of grief. Anybody can grab a grief book. You know, you search on Amazon. I don't know, there's thousands that pop up, okay? They're going to give you kind of that simple version of, here's what grief is, let's boil it down. I'm going to kind of teach you about what are some of the things that you might not read about. What are some of the things that you might not notice or you might overlook, but that are probably happening in that person who is grieving. And how do you partner with them in these really kind of challenging aspects of grief that don't get talked about, okay? And so with that, this talk is focused on people who are experiencing pretty intense grief. This is not for somebody who said, oh, I experienced, for lack of a better word, kind of a minor loss,
and I'm having a grief reaction, but it's pretty mild, we're focused on these more significant, intense grief reactions for this talk and kind of what that looks like. Okay, so let's get into this. Who in here, who I have not talked to about this before, has ever heard of the just world belief? So a couple people maybe have kind of heard about it. So you're like, oh my gosh, why are you talking to me about something called the just world belief? All right, I gotta give you some background on this. Hold on, I got too many things. Okay, so before I can connect this belief to grief, I have to tell you kind of what it is. So we learn information in kind of really cool ways from the time that we're little all the way to the time that we're older, okay? When we experience new things in our life, we create what we call in psychology a cognitive schema. Basically, it's just a category or a bucket. We create a bucket in our brain for that information. So for example, we have a two-year-old, okay, who's learning how to speak, and looks over and sees Fido, right, and says, okay, four legs, tail, fur, dog, right? That's a dog. So that two-year-old now has this category in his brain, an animal with four legs, a tail, and fur. That's a dog. Perfect. So then let's say mom and dad take him over to the zoo, and he sees a tiger for the first time, right? What do you think he's going to call that tiger? Dog, right? Animal, four legs, tail, fur. Dog, right? And then the parent is like, no, that's a cat. No, it's not, right? No. Okay. As we grow and as we develop, we create more refined and more sophisticated categories to kind of place information in our life into. So that child starts to learn, okay, here's dogs, but there's different categories of dogs, right? These are cats. There's different categories of cats. And we kind of build up all of these categories and we refine them as we grow and we use them to make sense of our world. So when I go into a new situation, I'm pulling from these old categories and saying, where does this fit? Okay? So one of these categories that we're raised with in this culture is something that's called the just world belief. Okay? So at its most simplistic version, it's good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. If you do the right thing, something good happens. If you do the wrong thing, something bad happens. Hopefully, as I say that, you're like, flawed. That is not right. We can look at that and say that that's flawed. That belief dominates our life. From the time that we're itty-bitty, this is what we teach people in our culture, right? I don't tell my three-year-old, if you steal a cookie, I might not know, and you're going to just have a great time and enjoy it. No, if you steal a cookie, I'm going to find out, right? You're going to get in trouble. We tell the 8 or 9-year-old at school, if you cheat on the test, you're going to fail. We don't tell them that reality is, you might cheat on the test and nobody knows and you get an A. Cool, right? That's not how we teach people, right? We teach people, you do this, this is the consequence. You do the right thing, something good happens. You do the wrong thing, something bad happens, okay? Even if you think, I get how some people have that, but I probably don't. Think about what happens, say you hear about a car accident. What are the first questions that people ask when you hear about a car accident? Throw it out there.
Were they wearing their seatbelt?
Were they wearing their seatbelt?
Were they texting?
Were they intoxicated? Were they texting? Were they distracted? Were they speeding? That's the just world belief. Something bad happened. My first question is, what did they do wrong? If they didn't do it wrong, then was the other person speeding? Was the other person doing something wrong? It gives us a false sense of security about our life. Right? It's a control strategy for us. So I don't want to go through life thinking, oh my gosh, I could walk out of here today and through no fault of anybody's, something horrific could happen. That's a scary way to walk through life. So I assume that if I do all of the right things, right, things are gonna work out. So here's the kicker. You experience loss. Loss doesn't fit into that just world belief neatly. So what we tend to do when we experience something that doesn't fit into our category, we try to shove it in there anyways. We're trying to make that tiger into a dog, right? And the way that we tend to do that is by owning the blame ourselves. Okay? So if somebody is grieving, we're talking about a loss, what did I do wrong? If only I didn't ask them to stay to watch that movie. If only I called the doctor sooner. If only I didn't do this 5 years ago, right? If only, you know, if we're talking about schools and what's been going on in our schools, if only I didn't send my kid to a public school, if only I didn't send my kid to a private school, right? And it turns into this ownership of fault and blame, which then fuels guilt and shame throughout the grieving process, okay? That can destroy somebody who is grieving. What's really interesting is that when the way that our brain works is when we have thoughts, if they stay inside our head, our automatic kind of assumption is that they are true. When we speak them aloud and when we write them down, we automatically get a different perspective on them. Because we get enough distance that we hear it or we see it and we're like, whoa, wait a minute, hold on. Maybe that's not fully true. The person who is grieving needs somebody who is trustworthy enough to be able to show up and hear that. And to not reject it and say, stop it, it's not your fault, that's ridiculous. They don't need to hear that. They need somebody to listen to their fear, to their shame, to their guilt, to those thoughts that show up that say, I have ownership over this. They need somebody to listen so they can hear it themselves. So they can start to look at, is this mine? Is this really mine? Am I at fault or is something else going on here? Right? It's hard to sit with that when you see somebody owning something that is not theirs to own. But I would encourage you, sit with it. Okay? Those beliefs and those thoughts can be very, very powerful and very, very sticky. And if you are sitting with somebody and they're stuck in that, that's actually a time when therapy can be really worthwhile. Okay, I do that in therapy all the time. We look for those, we call them kind of stuck points. We look for those and we explore them and allow them to be. But for a lot of people, all they need is somebody to just sit down and listen and be present with that and then not throw that kind of guilt and shame back on them and to see it. So just know that as somebody's grieving, they may be owning things that aren't theirs to own, and they need somebody who can handle that and who can listen to that. Along with that, for you, the supporter, that's happening with you too, right? Doesn't make us bad people that we have this just world belief. That's just us. That's what we're raised in. That's what we're trained in. That's just what we do automatically. So know that that's there with you. Also understand that when you see somebody else's pain, it's really uncomfortable for you. Okay? We want to get rid of other people's pain. When we see somebody hurting and experience loss, sometimes our first thought is, what if I went through that? What would I be doing? I don't know if I could handle that. So we feel really uncomfortable and really afraid, and we start to feel the pain. So we want to then create more predictability in our life. And we do that by using our lovely just world belief. If I can assign blame, if I can make it somebody's fault, if I can find something that is wrong, I feel safer. I feel more settled. Okay? I feel more in control. So while it will reduce our own discomfort to figure out where do we put that blame, it does nothing but hurt the person who is grieving to do that with them. And you want to catch that because it's automatic, right? So-and-so just got in a car accident, right? The first, were they speeding, right? I mean, it's just automatic. So you have to be aware that that's there for you because that has no place with the person who is grieving. You can ask those questions. There's nothing wrong with asking those questions. Not to that person, okay? You can work through that on your own, okay, with somebody else who you care about. But the place to do it is not with that person who is in pain and grieving because you don't want to layer, right, that sense of guilt and that sense of blame on this person that shouldn't own that necessarily, okay? Yeah. Let me see what else I was going to say with that. Yeah. So along with that, we tend to hate ambiguity. Part of partnering with people who are grieving is being comfortable being in a space where you don't have answers. And the world is not predictable, and you don't have control. That's part of it. One thing that I've kind of noticed in the last few months of my own life, as many of you know, so my mom had a massive stroke in October. She should not have survived it, but she made it through. Okay? is still experiencing the effects of it, but she made it through, right? Part of that just world belief that gets tricky is we're looking at this woman who has never smoked, never drank, okay, or had a beer here and there, right? Eats very, very healthy, exercises all the time, is my size, so she's not overweight, right? Very, very active, zero risk factors for stroke. And so one of the things that as people came into the ICU, as we were waiting to see if she would make it, you know, part of the things that people would come in saying, well, this isn't fair, this isn't right. She didn't deserve this. This shouldn't be happening because she doesn't have X, Y, or Z. And they were really struggling with, where do I assign blame, right? And it's hard to walk through life. As somebody, I'm kind of, if you've ever met my mom, I'm my mom's twin. Okay, we're the exact same person. And to kind of think, I've had in my own head sometimes, wow, she did everything right. She's on the golf course and collapsed, right? That could be me tomorrow. I have the same life. We live kind of that same healthy way. What prevents that from being me? It's easier to if we could have said, oh yeah, no, she did this. She had super high blood pressure. She had super high cholesterol and threw a clot. No, this just happened. And can I live in a world and be next to somebody knowing that things that are awful, they just happen and we can't control them? Can I tolerate that space? And you know what? If you can't, that's okay. That's when you want to just step back a little bit from that person who's grieving and make space for somebody who can. Okay. Is that kind of making sense so far? Okay. So another thing that I want to talk about with grief just has to do with a person's identity. Okay. So when you experience a loss, part of that loss is a loss of your sense of self and your sense of who you are. Because by nature, we define ourselves by the roles that we are in. So I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a daughter, right? I'm a worker, I'm a psychologist, right? We define ourselves by these roles that we have. And loss fundamentally changes that role. So if I am no longer that, then what am I? Who am I? What does that life look like? If we're talking about a loss of a person, you're not only losing that role with that person, but think about all the other relationships in your life that might be built on that person. It's kind of the conduit. So if that person is gone, who am I to this person one time removed? Because I had a relationship with that person through this one. So now what is it? What does that look like, and who am I to them? Who should I be to them? Should that role completely change? These are questions that people who are grieving will feel very, very, very strongly. So it can be really, really isolating. It can be really frightening to have that sense of self shaken, right? And a lot of people who are grieving will pull away from relationships on purpose because I don't know who I am in this relationship anymore. And if I don't know who I am, I don't know how to do this, right? So when I see you, who's a friend who I love, who I care about, and I want to spend time with, not only now am I dealing with the loss of this person or the loss of my functioning or the loss of whatever it is I lost, but now I'm also dealing with an identity crisis with you. Because now I sit with you and I'm like, ah, I don't know. This is who I used to be. I'm not that person anymore. So how do I do this? So simply being with somebody who you love and care about when you're grieving, now you're just kind of getting smacked in the face with all sorts of loss. So people may tend to pull away. It's also not uncommon for people to seek out brand new strangers, right? I've never met you before. You are not the kind of person that I would have hung out before, but you know what? You don't know me. I have no identity with you. So I can walk in and it feels a little bit safer to be with you because I'm not hit with that identity crisis that I would have with this person that I've been close to for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So when you're walking alongside of somebody who's grieving, if they pull away, it might not be because you did anything wrong. It might be because they haven't figured out yet who they are with you. And they might seek out somebody completely new, not to reject you, but because that feels better in the moment. Okay, so again, some things that you might not read about with respect to grief when you're kind of looking at grief literature, but these are things that I see a lot in folks that I work with as kind of ways that they find themselves getting a little bit stuck or just kind of struggling throughout the grief process. Ooh, that's a lot all at once. Sorry. So tied into identity, right, and this identity crisis is also issues with knowing when I'm safe and when I'm not. What's a threat and what's not a threat, okay? So when somebody's identity is shaken, their sense of safety is shaken as well. Because I know how to do life as this person in this role. I don't know how to do life as this person now. And that's threatening to walk into every single situation new. Okay? Sort of like if you all can remember like when you went off to college, it was exciting, but like a little bit anxiety provoking, right? This is all new. This is brand new. All these new roles that I'm taking on. Well, times that by 1,000, right? Because everything has now shifted. So the questions that show up are, who am I in this relationship? Will this person accept me if I'm different? What if I can't be that person that I was before? Now are they going to reject me? So all of a sudden, grabbing a cup of coffee with somebody feels incredibly threatening, right? It's like a job interview. Okay? Walking in, will they still accept me? Can I do this? Can I be okay and can I be safe in this interaction? So for some, right, let's pull away because that's just a little bit easier. So I'm not going to have that interaction. I'm just going to stay. I'm going to stay in kind of a safe bubble for a period of time. Okay? Combined, right, with that lack of identity or that loss of identity is the lovely uncontrolled emotions that show up with grief. Super intense, not just sadness, right? Anger, frustration, fear, anxiety, even pleasant emotions. Joy can show up. And then that's super frightening when joy shows up for the first time after you've been grieving, and it's like, oh, shoot, oftentimes that's followed with guilt, right? How dare I feel a pleasant emotion when I've experienced this kind of loss? And so now you're fueled, right? You start with one little thing that starts out okay, and now we have this cascade of unpleasant emotions that just shows up, right? And it's not, you can't necessarily control it. So this is normal to have uncontrolled, intense emotions, okay? But it's also extremely frightening and overwhelming. So many people try to avoid. This is what we do as people, right? We try to avoid pain, okay? So some people do that by avoiding other people, right? I don't even want to have this interaction because it's going to be painful, so I'm going to avoid that person. Other people, especially in those very, very, very early months of grief, they may use alcohol. They may overuse medications. They may sleep excessively. They may eat excessively, right? Simply to get relief or respite. I know this is kind of wild, but what I want to tell you is that when that is done in small doses and for brief periods of time, that's okay. Okay? We have to be careful as people who are supporting folks who are grieving to not pathologize their reactions or to say that's a sign of a problem, right? You didn't used to have 3 beers at night to go to bed. Why are you having that tonight? Because they need a break and it's a short period of time. And that can be okay. So we want to be careful walking in and kind of judging somebody for behaving differently than they did before. They are trying to survive. And if you think about it, as they are on that life raft and those waves are coming, it's okay that they do some things that are out of the ordinary to survive that wave. That is okay. Okay? For extended periods of time in large amounts, that's something different. But in these really early stages, be present with them, be comfortable with them, and not everything that kind of seems like a problem actually is a problem, okay, if you just give it a little bit of time. Okay. The other thing that we see when folks have kind of their sense of safety threatened, okay, when inside of us is really chaotic and frightening and scary and kind of out of control, we get our sense of control from outside of us. Okay. So if we think to little kids and we think to toddlers, right, woo, chaotic, right? And inside is just, whoa, a mess. That's why toddlers thrive with structure, right? They don't have structure in here, so I'm getting the structure from outside of me, and that gives me a sense of safety and security, and I can flourish and I can grow. So when you're grieving and inside is a mess and inside is chaotic, well, I might then want to over-control. So you might have somebody who's grieving where you say, hey, let's grab a cup of coffee. When? Where? How long? What kind of coffee are we going to get? Who all is going to be there? What if we do this, right? Who's driving? Why are we driving there, right? Can we walk? And ask kind of questions like that for really basic kinds of situations, right? This sense of, I need that external control. My house is just the way it is, right? My car is just the way it is. I'm going to go to this event, but it better start on time, because if it doesn't start on time, oh no, right? You said it was starting at 7. It is now 7:15. Why is this not happening, right? Because I need that control so that I can feel like I'm okay and I'm safe in this moment. And when that control isn't there, I feel a little chaotic and I might go and I might run. And that can be okay, right? They can leave. They can do what they need to do to keep themselves safe and give themselves that sense of security. But be careful with being frustrated, right, with questions like that and maybe repeating the same information time and time and time again, because that's allowing that person to feel safe when for the majority of the day they feel very, very unsafe. Okay. Trust is another one that comes up. Okay. So the reality of grief is that people who support those who are grieving often do a terrible job. Not on purpose. They come into it with the best intentions, but they unintentionally end up hurting that person. Okay? And we're going to talk in a little bit kind of about some of the ways that we can unintentionally hurt people who are grieving. But when you have a lot of people in your life and they are unintentionally bringing hurt or harm to you, right, you start to lose that sense of trust. And again, you want to pull away a little bit. So we want to watch out for that. Folks who are grieving, right, they're also worried about, can I trust that if I develop a new relationship, that if I pursue this new hope, that I'm not going to lose it? Or am I just going to expect that I'm going to lose it? So I shouldn't, right, throw up my hands and say, okay, I'm done, right? I tap out because I can't trust that this is going to stay, so why even bother, right? So there's kind of that trust in the hope of what is to come, and that kind of gets shaken. And then trust in God is absolutely shaken. Can I trust in God's goodness? It's a question that I hear a lot when people are kind of walking through trauma and grief, right? When we're walking alongside of somebody and somebody is questioning God, maybe questioning his goodness, whether or not he's even there, right? It can be really tempting for us to defend God, right? Oh, no, let me tell you why he's so good. Let me tell you why he's we take on the defense of God. What I would argue is that God doesn't need our defense. Okay? The amazing thing about God is that he chose on purpose to experience grief. And for those people who have been intimately acquainted with powerful, powerful, powerful loss, it's amazing that he chose that. He could have avoided that. He knows what it's like to lose a son. He put himself in that exact situation. So he is intimately acquainted with that process. And it's my firm belief that he is 100% okay with you asking questions and with you bringing every emotion that he has given you to him. We as supporters, we don't need to fight for him. We don't need to correct that relationship. The relationship with him does that. All we need to do is show up and let somebody say, I don't know that I can trust in God anymore. Okay? Right? I don't have to give you 10 verses for this is why you should, right? I'm going to pray with you, and I'm going to pray that God speaks to you. But even knowing when you're praying with somebody, I'm not going to pray, God, with that person there, I believe that so-and-so will trust in you again. She will know that you are good. Not praying in that way, right? God, talk to her in whatever way you want. Show up. You teach her. Help me be with this person. Right? Those are the kinds of ways to support people when they're kind of having that crisis of faith. Don't pull up his sword. He doesn't need us. He loves us. He likes us to be around, but he doesn't need us to do that part. And when we do that part, what we end up doing is we push people away. Because we tell them, it's not okay to have that thought. It's not okay to have that feeling. At least it's not okay around me. Something's wrong with you because you're questioning. Something's not wrong with them because they're questioning. They should be questioning. Don't also assume, though, that grief may, in fact, kind of swing the opposite way, and it may actually, you know, in an incredible way, strengthen that person's relationship with God as well. So don't assume that everybody's faith is shaken in God. That's not the case. Some people's faith is really bolstered and strengthened throughout that process. But no, if their faith is shaken, that's okay. That's okay. Okay. Oh, so intimacy. So intimacy is something that we don't often talk about. I talk about it a lot with the clients that I work with, and they usually will give me like this strange look. Why are you talking to me about intimacy? What do you even mean? And then I say, intimacy with yourself, and they're like, what is wrong with you? Like, where is this conversation going? And I'm like, no, this is a completely different conversation, okay? Intimacy with yourself is about knowing who the heck you are. It's also about knowing how to comfort yourself, okay? Think about it. We're really good with comforting a lot of times other people. I like to think about especially little ones, right? They get hurt. My daughter fell off her bike a couple of days ago, right? So I come up to her, pick her up. I snuggle her. I say nice things to her. I talk quietly to her. We put a Band-Aid on that solves no problems, but she thinks it does, right? So that is, it's comforting, that is soothing. I am not taking away her pain. Nothing that I do or say in the moment makes her scratched elbow hurt less, but she feels different, right? So I know what she needs for comfort, okay? When we kind of have that sense of ourself shaken, we start to get confused about what do I need now, right? We tend to rely, in general, on other people to offer us comfort, but if I'm not sure that I trust them and I don't feel safe with them, how do I go to them for comfort, right? I don't know what I like or dislike anymore because my whole sense of self is shaken. And then add to that, oh, by the way, I don't like me now. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be this person because you know what? I want to be that person. I liked that person and I liked that role. And I'm not that anymore. And so it leads to kind of this fundamental kind of rejection of who you are in this moment. And when you reject you, how can you actually begin to understand what it is that you need and how to actually care for yourself effectively? Okay? It can also lead to this problem of kind of over-idealizing this person, right? This person was amazing, was perfect, and we kind of forget this person was not perfect, right? Mm-hmm. But when I'm over here, oh my gosh, that looks really, really, really good, right? And I want that. So we see people kind of with this desire for how do I go back here? You can't, right? You cannot. You're fundamentally changed. So if I was sitting in a therapy room, I would do an amazing drawing for somebody sitting in front of me. The skill of my drawing is it would be a circle. It could be a square. That's the extent of my drawing skills, right? You were a circle before. You are a square now because loss changes you. You're trying to turn that square back into a circle, and you can't. And you get stuck doing that. We want to explore what the heck is this square? Who is this square? And you know what? If you don't want to be this square, cool. We're going to look at moving forward. Maybe we shift that into a triangle in the future. But we can't actually go back. And so trying to kind of walk through this process of being with somebody who isn't connected to themselves and feels pretty lost, and allowing space for that person to be lost with you. Okay. Also, right, building close connections, I've talked about this a lot already, building close connection with others can be terrifying, right? So it's safer to stay disconnected than to experience this kind of loss again, or nobody understands, so why bother? Right? As people try to comfort me, they tell me, oh, you'll get over it. Time will heal all wounds. Well, it could have been a lot worse, right? They don't understand the intensity of that pain in the moment. So why do I want to build a connection with them? If they can't see that my pain is real, how can they understand any other part of me? If they can't see that, you know, all aspects of my experience are affected by this loss, how can I trust them, right? And how can I build a close connection with them and expect to really, really have somebody who's partnering with me? I'll just go. All right. So, how do we do this job then? If we're talking about kind of some of the nuances of grief, like we have been, how do we do the job of walking alongside of somebody who is grieving? Okay. First and foremost, your job is to not make that person feel better. Okay. It's about jumping in the water with them and holding on for dear life when that wave comes. We have the incorrect assumption, I think, in our culture, that sadness and joy, they're on the same pole. Sadness is over here, joy is over here. They're opposite ends of a spectrum. That's a lie. They're not. They are completely separate emotions, okay? Which means that you can have guilt, you can have anger, you can have joy, you can have peace, you can have fear, you can have some level of all of those at the same time. They are not mutually exclusive. You do not have to remove pain or sadness to experience joy. You can have them both, okay? So it is possible for life to be rich and meaningful and to still feel empty at the same time. So it's not about making them okay. It's understanding that they are complex and they are intricate and they can experience seemingly opposite things at the exact same time. And we get into trouble when we say, well, I have to get rid of your pain first before we can do anything else. Because you're not going to get rid of their pain, right? You are not going to stop that wave. And the attempts to try to get rid of that pain is basically like, well, I'm going to get out of this ocean, right? I'm going to be in a helicopter, and I'm going to just look down and say, eh, it's not that bad, right? No, the wave's not actually coming. That's a lie, right? As that person is drowning under that 100-foot wave, they're saying, no, it's real, and it's here, right? So it's about saying, yeah, your pain is real, and it is there. And we're looking for ways to also have life and allowing those to be present at the same time. Okay? So it's about being joyful with them, knowing that even if joy is laced with pain, it doesn't make it less rich. Okay. So with that, we need to understand, we're on that second point, that this experience is painful for you as well. So as you, the supporter, right, we kind of talked about it before, grief makes us confront our own fears. It makes us confront our own humanity. It makes us realize that we are temporary beings and that things are not perfect life, perfect health, that's not promised to us, right? And at some point we're going to experience loss. So that's really scary and frightening, okay? And so it's really tempting to try to remove those emotions from yourself, right, as quickly as possible. And the way that we do that is we kind of dismiss the person who's grieving. We dismiss their pain. Well, if I tell you, oh, it's not so bad, well, that makes me feel better. It doesn't make you feel better, right? If I tell you, eh, just give it a little bit of time and it will be better. It doesn't make them feel better. It makes me feel better. Because now I have the assumption, oh, it's short. So in a way, we're kind of lying to ourselves to try to reduce our own pain. Process, we're hurting that person who is grieving. So we need to understand that it's hard for us. And we also need to understand that sometimes we're in a place in our life where we can't jump in that water. Or maybe I can jump in and maybe I can take one wave with you and then I gotta tag out, right? Because that's all that I can take right now. That is okay. You don't have to be there 24/7 in the water with that person, but you want to know ahead of time, can I do this? And if I can't get in that water, okay, then I need to step back and let somebody step in, okay? The people who are grieving need to be heard, even when they don't say a word, and they need you to see the extent of their grief. They need you to believe that it is every bit as bad as they say it is, or every bit as bad as they don't say it is, and at the same time to believe that they will survive it. They need you to have both of those things. So kind of with that, right, you see those waves coming, you see them struggling, it can be incredibly tempting to try to save someone from their grief. Okay? So not only is it impossible, but it's actually really harmful. And here's what's challenging. The person who is grieving may actually come up to you and say, fix it, make me feel better, get rid of this. Mm-hmm. Of course they would, right? They are just trying to survive. They are drowning, and they're saying, somebody change this for me. Do it. And that's really hard as a supporter to look at them and say, I can't. I will show up with you. And I desperately want to save you from this. And I can't. Right? You are in this ocean and I have no power to stop those waves. Right? Grief by nature . So if we step in and we try to save somebody from their grief or reduce their pain in this moment, What we're actually doing is we're setting them up for more pain down the road. Okay? I have worked with people who it's 50 years later, and we're back at step one. Why? Because everybody told me I should just shove it down and move on. So I did. Okay? You can't shove something down forever. It will weigh you out, and it will say, I am here, and I am affecting you whether you realize it or not, because I have a job to do. And this job is to teach you how to live again, this new life. You have to experience it. You have to walk through it if you're going to secure a healthy future, not a pain-free future, a healthy future. You've got to walk through this process. So we don't want to try to just get rid of the pain. We just want to try to be with them. And then also understand that this person is never going to be the same, right? They're not that circle, okay? So there's this song that's out now. I don't even know who it's by, Jennifer and somebody else. But the song is called You're Gonna Be Okay. Has anybody heard that song? Okay, it's beautiful. Like, music is beautiful. I now really dislike it. Okay? As I was making this talk, I was like, ah! Because part of it is they're talking about grief in this song. And they're singing about that loss. And it's beautifully written. The music is beautiful. And then at the chorus, the statement is, you're going to be okay. I wish what they would have said is, you're going to make it. You're going to survive. I don't like the language of you're going to be okay. You are fundamentally changed. Okay? That's the reality of grief. You are different. That can be okay to be different. But if a lot of times when we say, oh, you're going to be okay, we make the assumption that, yeah, you're going to go back. Just give it time. You'll be that. You're not. So you're not going to be that. Tied to that, if we're talking about somebody that you love and you care about, looking at them and saying, they're not going to be the same person that I knew, is painful. This may cause a grief reaction in you, right? When you look at somebody that you've known for months, for years, for decades, and you say, wait a minute, this person is different. You may be grieving your own loss of that individual as the circle, right? It was so easy. This is what our relationship was. It was perfect. It was safe. It was all of that. Oh, now they're different. Ah, right? So if we just try to hide from that fact, we get nowhere, okay? It doesn't work because you can't hide from the fact they're different. If you, as a supporter, is just waiting out the storm, expecting them to go back at some point, that's also not. So the question is, as a supporter, am I willing to tolerate my own grief and my own discomfort as I walk next to this person and adapt now to who they are and create an entirely new relationship? Am I willing to do that? Or am I still trying to fight and pull them back because that's what I need and that makes me feel better? Kind of tied to that, when you're walking alongside of somebody who's grieving, we have to remember, right, relationships are a give and take. Okay? So we're in relationships with people because we get our emotional needs met by them. They get their emotional needs met by us, right? It's this lovely give and take. Okay? So part of what we have to think about is there are some people who, by nature, are helpers, they're rescuers, they're savers, right? I see somebody in trouble, I want to save you. I want to rescue you. I want to help. If you are that kind of person, that's awesome. That's great. Being with somebody in the early stages of grief is incredibly risky for you if you are that kind of person. Because there is a really high opportunity for you to potentially cause harm. Not on purpose, right? But if by nature you're like, I want to save you, grief is something that you can't be saved from, right? So we're already coming into a conflict right there, okay? Your own desire to help is probably going to make it more difficult for you to see their pain, okay? This sounds kind of depressing, but I'm going to throw it out there anyways. If you are somebody that is walking alongside of somebody who's grieving, especially in the early stages, if you walk away from that interaction with that person, and you feel really good. Yeah, I was super helpful. I did a great job. All right. You feel good leaving that interaction. the person who is grieving is likely harmed. Right? They are in the water, the waves are crashing. Walking away from that saying, yeah, I helped them, you probably said something that made you feel good, but that didn't make them feel good. Okay? So I say this, you know, with the utmost respect and love for people who are helpers. I'm a helper by nature. That's why I have the job that I have. But I also know that when people are really struggling, I have an internal pull. I want to show up. I want to say, hey, right? I want to invite myself in. Guess what? I got all sorts of knowledge that I can pour on you, right? The griever doesn't need knowledge, right, in that moment. I have a pull, and I have to see that pull, and I have to stop, right? And I have to say, nope. If they call me, great. If they text me, great. I am there when they ask. But I cannot step into that and provide something that that person does not need. Because that's me getting my needs met because I want to help. That's not in the service of the person who is grieving. So if you are that kind of helper, be very, very cautious, right? And maybe for a period of time choose to step back on purpose. Love that person from afar so that the people who can tolerate that pain without the need to rescue, they're there. And down the road, you come back in when it's a safer time. Okay. Tied to that, maybe you've experienced your own loss, right? Grief shows up for everybody. So a lot of people who have experienced their own loss want to come in and say, hey, this is what's going to happen, right? That can be a great, great thing. It can also be a little bit risky because what worked for you might not work for this person. So it can sometimes be a little bit easy to kind of give a prescription. Oh, well, you just do this, 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 and this. And 10 years later, you're going to be here where I'm at, right? We don't necessarily want to do that, right? It can also be scary if you've experienced your own loss to be genuinely honest with that person about what's coming, right? You might want to say, oh, I don't want to tell them that, right? Ooh, this is awful, right? And so you kind of, there's this struggle there between here's what worked for me, this is what my grief was, and that expectation that this is what your grief should be like, because this grief is going to be different. So show up, and if people ask questions, great, but understand that what worked for you might not work for them, and that's totally okay. And what worked for you may very well work for them, and that's awesome as well. Okay, so tips. So what do we do with all of this? Okay. So number one, again, I'm not going to give you a prescriptive plan step by step of what to do, but just kind of some general guidelines when you're walking alongside of somebody who is grieving. Number one, be with them. Silence is golden. You do not have to speak. And I hear people say all the time, I'm going out with this person who's experienced this loss. What do I say? Right? And they'll ask me that because I'm a psychologist. I talk for a living, right? And my usual response is nothing. Show up. Be next to them on that life raft, on that piece of the wreckage. When a 100-foot wave is coming, you're not talking through it anyways, right? You're just hanging on with them. Be, right? Know that that is okay to be. Being is far more beneficial than any words that you have because you are present with them and you see them. Validate the pain. It is that bad. And I hate that it is that bad. And I don't want it to be that bad. And I want it to be better. But I see it's that bad right now. It is. Validate it. We kind of were afraid sometimes that if we recognize somebody's pain, that somehow that's going to like phenomenally increase the pain. It's actually the opposite. When we don't recognize pain, what happens? That then skyrockets. No, you don't see how bad it is. It's got to up the ante. So if it increases, then maybe you can see it, right? If we don't recognize our own pain, it's just going to grow, right? No, pay attention to me. If you're not going to pay attention to me when I'm at a 50 out of 100, well, I'm going to amp it up to 90 out of 100 so then you're ready to pay attention to me. So the invalidation, the not recognizing the presence of that pain actually makes it go up. Recognize it. Speak it. See it. Always ask yourself the question before any interaction with somebody who's grieving, is this for me or is this for them? Right? am I interacting with this person for selfish reasons? Because it's going to make me feel good? Because I miss them and I want to have that connection? I want to have that mentorship? I want to have whatever it is? Or am I here for them? Okay? Relationships are a give and take, not in the early stages of grief. Okay? At some point, that relationship will be a give and take again. But in this phase, you're the giver as a supporter. And if you're able to do that, great. If you're relying on that person to meet your needs, then you want to go maybe look for somebody else to get that need met so that you can then show up and be ready to be there for them during this stage. Okay. Hold their words and actions lightly. Don't take offense. It's not about you. Okay. The nature of grief is uncontrolled emotions, right? So maybe they lash out at you. Okay. Right? Maybe they are really angry with you. Okay. Maybe they show up at your house and they leave 2 minutes later. Okay. Okay. It's not about you. This is where they are at right now. Okay. Don't take offense. That person might not remember what they told you the next day. Because when those emotions are so strong, that logical part of our brain shuts off. Right? And it's just emotions. So they might not even know. So be there, right? And then in the next interaction, let it go. Don't hold tightly to that and just show up. Provide careful, intentional, practical support. Okay? But at the same time, allow the person who's grieving, ooh, that got loud, to have control. Okay? So things like, I'm gonna come mow your lawn, I'm gonna cook you food, I'm gonna babysit kids, I'm gonna clean your house. Awesome. Don't just walk in and just do it. Okay? And part of the reason for that is because maybe you show up and maybe you do 5 loads of laundry. And maybe what you wash is the last item from that person who is now gone. And now it doesn't smell like them anymore. Really, really thoughtful actions can still cause harm. So you want to allow that person to have a sense of control. Yeah, clean. Don't touch that room. Okay? Come and do this. Allow me to do some things. Right? If we're talking about a loss of functioning, right, or an injury, and that person is grieving, right, that loss, let me step in and help. But I don't want to do everything for you. What are the things that you want to learn how to do? Perfect. I'm not going to touch that for you, right? So allow them to have that sense of, this is still mine, and I have people there and ready to support me on these tasks that I just don't have the energy to do, but I have control of what's being done. Run interference. So if you're somebody that's really close to that person, right, people come out of the woodworks during a time of loss. And so the amount of people that want to interact with somebody during the acute phases of grief is just astronomical. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that's not what that person needs, right? They're trying to survive. They're trying to get through the moment. They're trying to kind of navigate this new world. So maybe if you're really close to that person, ask them if they want you to run interference. Everybody goes through you. They screen people, right? You would screen people for that person who is grieving to figure out, who can you see today, if anybody? What excuse do you want me to give today? Okay, if you don't want to see anybody, let me take that role for you. You know what? Let me take your phone tonight so you can sleep and it's not going to buzz. And I'll field all of that and it'll be waiting for you in the morning, right? Run some of that interference. Be agenda-free. Get rid of expectations, okay? Don't expect that person who's grieving to show up when you invite them. Don't expect them to stay for an entire event. Don't expect them to stay for 10 minutes. Right? Don't expect them to be happy. Don't expect them to be sad. Right? Roll in. Whatever this is fine. If you've got 3 minutes and that's all you've got, perfect. We got 3 minutes. Right? If you have this, great. If we start out this interaction and we're having a lovely, fun, good time, and all of a sudden you're crying, I don't know what happened, cool. Right? That's life. We're not expecting, right, this person to feel or do something or another. We're just seeing what happens. And then most importantly, love. Right? Love them. Don't change them. Love them. Okay? And remember, right, grief is born out of love. So love is what tends to be most healing. So show up in love, and that can look all sorts of ways. Okay, So with that, I want to go back to my lovely old man, who I would love to meet in person because he's incredible. I want to read to you what he says kind of the second part of the story is. This is my favorite part of it. And for those of you that know me really well, you know that I don't cry. Maybe like once a year, just doesn't happen. Dang it, this gets me every time. I have tried to read through this sucker on my own. I'm not going to make it. So my husband is going to be shocked, and I'm going to be like, Dan, I cried when I was talking to people. And he's like, what? You never cried. It's probably going to happen. So bear with me if I kind of pause as I try to get through it. But the words are incredibly powerful and meaningful. And so what I want to end this talk with is his words as a very, I think, very wise person that has been walking this journey. And I want you all to know that while grief looks like this, and is challenging, and is painful, and is hard, you don't have to get stuck in that early stage. It looks different as you grow, and you can keep moving. And I think his words give light to that fact that you don't have to be stuck, and that you can survive it. Okay, so bear with me. Okay, so this is what he says about the later stages of grief. So after a while, maybe weeks, maybe months, maybe years, you'll find the waves are still 100 feet tall, but they come further apart. When they come, they still crash all over you and wipe you out. But in between, you can breathe. You can function. You never know what's going to trigger the grief. It might be a song, a picture, a street intersection, the smell of a cup of coffee. It can be just about anything, and the waves come crashing. But in between waves, there is life. All right. So somewhere down the line, and it's different for everybody, you find that the waves are only 80 feet tall or 50 feet tall. And while they still come, they come further apart and you can see them coming. An anniversary, a birthday, Christmas, or landing at O'Hare. You can see it coming for the most part and prepare yourself. And when it washes over you, you know that somehow you will again come out the other side, soaking wet, sputtering, still hanging on to some tiny piece of the wreckage, but you'll come out. Take it from an old guy. The waves never stop coming, and somehow you don't really want them to. But you learn that you'll survive them, and other waves will come, and you'll survive them too. And if you're lucky, you'll have lots of scars from lots of loves and lots of shipwrecks. Because scars are a testament to life. They are a testament that I can love deeply and live deeply and be cut or even gouged, and that I can heal and continue to live and continue to love. And the scar tissue is stronger than the original flesh ever was. Scars are a testament to life. Scars are only ugly to people who can't see. So, my hope for you all today is that you will be able to see the beauty in those scars. That you will know that grief is a manifestation of love, and that you will find a way to make space for the pain and the joy, the pretty and the ugly, the loss of what was, and the life that still is to come. Thank you. So what we're going to do now, I'm going to introduce Susie to you. She probably doesn't need an introduction. I think probably all of you know Susie. So that's kind of the clinical kind of piece of it. The knowledge piece of it, and Susie is just gracious enough today to be willing to share, you know, her own personal journey through grief, and kind of what was helpful to her, what things were maybe less helpful to her, to kind of put a real life face to some of this information, and to hopefully encourage you through your grief journey and through the support that you're giving to people who are grieving. So Susie's going to get the mic.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to read directly from this paper because this was healing for me. Anyway, sorry, have to introduce myself first. Anyone who doesn't know me? I'm also probably not going to look at people. Okay. My name's Susie Schumacher. I'm a member here at Covenant Church. Carissa, we run together, and she's been such a gift to me, just a blessing, and has walked through with me very graciously. It helps that she's a psychologist, so I'm just lucky. But she asked me, it was a long time ago, I think, but she asked me to share my personal story of grief. And before I get started, because he's the one I've like ran through this a million times with, Phil and I are excited for this opportunity to share this. I'm happy to be in a place that I can share. He's happy for me. We're excited to share what the Lord has done in our lives and the path he used to bring us together. Our hope is that you find encouragement through my journey of grief. And our main desire is that it ultimately brings glory to God, who, by the way, I was mad at too for a long time. So if my story is able to bring hope to one person's hopeless heart, it puts purpose to my pain and loss, and purpose and loss is super important. It helps you to continue to walk to know that there's purpose and that it wasn't for nothing. So C.S. Lewis says, I love this quote, We can ignore even pleasure, but pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. My hope is that my story will open your soul to God, that although bad things happen that we don't understand, his good and perfect purpose is being worked out in each one of our lives. Okay, so back to a little bit about my current life. I'm married to Phil. He's a servant to the core. He makes me laugh. He loves me when I'm at my best, and he loves me when I'm at my worst. He might not always like me when I'm at my worst, but he still loves me, which we know is different. We jumped right into parenthood. We have 3 kids together. Nolan, who's 4, going to be 5, Liam, who's 3, going to be 4, and Jean, our spunky little redhead, who's 1, who'll be turning 2 soon. I own a photography business, and we're building our first and hopefully last home on a beautiful piece of land in BG. Had someone told me 11 years and 4 months ago that I'd be blessed by all of the above, I wouldn't have believed them. At 31 years old, my life feels split in 2. My life now and my life before death touched it. There is a group of girls, Mandy and Kim, we all grieved around the same time, a similar loss. And so they're like my sisterhood. I can call them after not talking for 4 years, and we're almost immediately like right back where we were. So anyways, I just randomly met up with her for drinks this week just to connect because I needed that. Because being understood is really important as well. So my friend Mandy put it more eloquently than I ever could on her 10-year anniversary of her grief journey, so I'm just going to read her words because I just thought they were perfect. Mandy wrote, 10 years later, I still struggle with what to say. I've tried to summarize how 10 years feels over the last few days, but I keep typing up ramblings. How can I accurately write what it's like to lose a spouse of 24? What it's like to grieve alone and to try to resume some semblance of life? But then, out of nowhere, finding yourself 10 years later, remarried, kids, 1/3 of the way through your career, and living an entirely new life. How do you just succinctly explain to someone that the fact that one of these 2 lives doesn't replace the other, and that the 2 lives will somehow always live simultaneously inside your being? How do you explain that grief can live permanently alongside joy? Or that the ache of what was and what could have been will exist comorbidly with the peace and happiness of what currently is? How can I capture that reality in 10 years, that everything has changed, and yet nothing about love or grief has? The truth is, you can't. So I find myself rambling. She put it perfectly, a life split, but both parts of the story beautiful in their own way. So, okay, back to for me. I met Preston Paul 11 years and 4 months ago. We met in Mrs. Hackworth's cooking class, and a few months later, he asked me to his senior prom. We went as friends and remained friends for a few months. By God's divine work and my incessant, maybe even annoying prayers, he accepted Jesus as a Savior, and the scripture says in 2 Corinthians 5:17, this means that anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new person. The old life is gone, a new life has begun. In some ways, Preston's life was also split into life before Christ and life after. We started dating and became serious pretty quickly. Preston was kind, quiet, confident, had a great sense of humor, made me laugh, and loved being outdoors. He was the first person I had ever dated, and I was sure we'd eventually get married. We dated for around 4 years, and in September 2006, we were finally engaged. We, my mom and I, got to planning our wedding right away, and by mid-September, I had already tried on dresses and had our hall booked. June 16th was our wedding date. On October 1st, I helped pack Preston up into his little blue pickup truck for school. He was attending Hocking College down in Nelsonville, Ohio, near Athens. I did not know at the time that this would be the last time I hugged him. The next morning, October 2nd, my mom and dad came to my apartment door early in the morning, and with stricken looks on their faces, my first thought was, one of my grandparents must have suddenly passed away. When they told me that Preston had been in a terrible car accident, I didn't believe them. Once the news set in, I proceeded to throw up and started screaming uncontrollably. I probably woke up my entire apartment building. I then sort of fell, ran down my apartment stairs, and immediately went to his parents' house. This is the one instance where the movies really do get it right. Tragic and sudden loss has a visceral reaction. My life for the next year felt like I was living a nightmare when I was awake, and my dreams felt like my normal life. Certain that my life was over. I would never love again. That I'd never have children, never be able to hold a job. The list goes on and on. Truthfully, every part of my future plans included Preston. And so a future without Preston was not a future I was interested in or wanted to live. So, spoiler alert, when Carissa said she wanted to ask me some questions, you know, she talked about grieving people like control. You're going to tell me every question you're going to ask me, and we're going to pretend like it's natural, but it's not. So you can ask me some questions that I have completely written out answers to.
So we thought it would be nice to have Susie, who's incredibly open and forthcoming and honest about her experiences and with her willingness to just be raw and to be truthful about her pain and not try to hide it. We thought it would be helpful if I kind of asked some questions about some of the things that I had mentioned earlier today in the talk to get her perspective so that you can actually hear from somebody who's been walking the grief journey, what works, what doesn't work, what it kind of looked like for her. So that's kind of our intention here. So here goes scripted questions. So one of the things that I didn't touch on but is a really real reality of grief is the toll it takes on your physical body. Grief brings with it physical damage to the body. So I just wanted to see if Susie would kind of share with us some of the physical symptoms of grief that she experienced.
Okay, so I found grief to be extremely physical, which I did not expect, I guess. I had some major physical side effects, and a lot of the people in the room here saw me when I was grieving. So you might remember some of these things. The major ones to note were weight change and actual heartache. I was down to 95 pounds. Yes, I didn't eat much, but everyone thought I wasn't eating at all. I was actually eating, but the food wouldn't stay in me. It's like my body was struggling to thrive. Even if I did eat, I couldn't keep it in me. My second side effect that I really noticed was that my heart hurt. You hear about anxiety like something sitting on your chest, but it's actually a thing. Like, this was actually my heart hurting. Broken heart syndrome, if you Google it, it's a thing. So that was definitely part of, like, the early stages for me. A few more side effects that I thought were, I mean, honestly, I still get some of these things today, which I also have 3 kids, so this could also add to it. Lack of focus, shortness of breath. My stomach was upset, like, constantly. That the feeling I had before I walked up here was, like, all the time. Like, it just felt all the time, like, upset. And I was exhausted. And I find that, like, when Chris talks about the waves, you know, like, you have waves. I start to see these things pop up. Chris knows I'm always trying to self-diagnose myself. But whenever I know a wave's coming in, usually I struggle to focus. And my stomach gets upset, and I'm exhausted. So I can kind of tell when grief is creeping up on me even 11 years later, because I sense those things.
You had mentioned, at least at the very beginning, kind of those intense, uncontrolled emotions that stayed. So what are some of the things that you did to cope with those emotions, especially in those earlier months?
Right. So when we talked about this question, I remember sitting, you have to remember I was really young, I'm 20 years old, and so it was a strange group of people to be around when you're grieving, because it's just not what they're used to. Not that anyone's used to grief, but 20-year-olds are definitely not used to grief. I can remember sitting with friends in a restaurant, genuinely having a good time, and all of a sudden a song would come on. It could be the song that Preston and I talked about dancing at our wedding to, or it could be the last song we danced to together before you passed. Immediately, I was in uncontrolled tears, like ugly crying in front of strangers. Super embarrassing. And I was like the official buzz killer on my 20-year-old friends. It was not, like, I was not fun to be around. Not knowing when these emotions would come out made me feel like I just wanted to hide. I don't know about everybody else, but I do not love being out of control emotionally around people. I prefer to do that in private, but grief has a way of sneaking up on you out of nowhere. I have another instance, as far as coping skills, I had some unhealthy coping at the beginning, but as we talked, it was healthy. It was part of my grief block. I remember going on spring break with a friend. P.S. Do not take a grieving friend on spring break. They are going to be terrible to be around. So I took Benadryl to sleep on the beach. I'm sure everybody does that. I drank to disconnect from my own emotions. I can't even describe how out of character this was for me. I remember filling up a Gatorade bottle with vodka and bringing it into a restaurant. That is not me. Like, I'm such a goody two shoes, never swore, you know, swearing started after the accident. So anyways, my friend, who was a little bit more into that kind of stuff, was like, ooh, this is a different side of Susie I've never seen. I got drunk a lot. Let's think, what else? Initially, alcohol was the way I calmed my unstable emotions. I just wanted to drink. I wanted to disconnect. I did not want to feel all the things because it was too much all the time.
Tell us all about some of the ways that people supported you really well during your early stages of grief.
So this is going to make you laugh if you guys know my mom. I can remember a specific instance where my mom was genuinely congratulating me on putting jeans on and putting makeup on. I was sort of living in sweatpants, and my eyes were constantly wet with tears, so mascara was not an option. She knew I was going to the bars. That's what I was doing. Not an ideal place for me, not a place I hung out before.
And she probably went and shared her fears with her friends. I'm sure you've heard of these things. But freaking out to me would not have been helpful. I was already certain I was not going to survive. So her concern for me, which was warranted, which at the beginning, she will tell herself, she told me about them, and that did not help me, and I kind of cut her off in some ways. But we learned how to grieve together. And had she expressed those to me, it would have only discouraged me. Now, had I continued to drink to numb my pain for years, then absolutely someone would have had to step in. But this was a grief stage for me, and it lasted around 3 to 4 months. I think what would be, like, instead of just telling all the things that were done wrong, I think, like, congratulating someone on any little thing they did. Because I cannot express to you how difficult it is to just get out of. Like, that was, I wanted a standing ovation for that, because that was so hard for me to do. I think just I'm noticing those kinds of things. Another way that my friends and family supported me really well was embracing the new version of me, and all the versions in between. I know they were probably missing who I was. Not that I was perfect before, but it was like I was just a different person. I didn't feel the same. But they were complementary of the things that I would had gained from grief. Instead of just noticing all the things I had lost. I'm not kidding, too. Like, grief puts you through stages. I had blue contacts for a period of time. Like, I wanted to just be someone totally different. Sharon did not like my blue contacts. but I got my hair highlighted right before the memorial service. That's weird. Like, but I did that because Preston always wanted to see what I looked like with highlights, and I was like, hey, let's do it, you know. So I feel like I was very sporadic at the moment and kind of did whatever I felt like doing. I think that's, yeah.
And then if we kind of flip it, tell us about some ways that people maybe unintentionally hurt you as they were trying their best to support you.
Yeah. And I think, too, there were definitely certain phrases. Any phrase that starts with, at least you weren't, were not helpful. It was, I was told pretty often, at least you weren't married, at least you didn't have kids. Bottom line, in my own experience, in my grief, who I'm walking with others who have grieved, grief rarely has a silver lining. Like, trying to tell someone about the silver lining is painful and frustrating. No part of my heart at the time was thanking God that we weren't married or that we didn't have a kid that I could remember him with. I would have given anything for more time, so telling me that at least I wasn't helpful, because at that point in my grief, I could not imagine my life being worse. So, yeah.
Who were the types of people that you found yourself being drawn to? And then who were the types of people that you kind of tended to stay away from or shy away from during those initial stages of grief?
So people I gravitated towards were humble, servant-hearted, were okay with sitting with me in the awkward silence. They had to like watching Friends with me because I watched like 1,000 seasons of Friends just to distract myself. When you were talking about like they may surround themselves with a totally new group of people. I did. Like, my sisters know, I had my friends, the Penny twins. I don't talk to them at all anymore, but, like, literally, they were the nicest guy friends ever. Like, completely platonic relationship. I don't even know what they're doing now, but they were, like, the nicest people ever. So, and it was comfortable because I didn't know them. So it was, like, just totally, it felt like a safer place for me sometimes than my family knows. For a period of time, they were kind of cut out, and I didn't want to talk to them. Like, I didn't know how to be my mom's daughter. I didn't know how to be my sister's sister. I didn't know how to be that person, so it was easier just to not have them, you know. And that might have been right at the beginning. People I shied away from were normally verbally concerned about me all the time. While I'm sure, while warranted, it wasn't comforting when I was already very concerned about my own future. I went from not drinking at all to just drinking all the time. I was concerned for me, too. Like, it was not. It felt out of character even as I was living it. Like, it just felt weird. So, telling me they're concerned just kind of, like, played into my fears that, like, I was never going to survive this kind of thing. Others were critical of how I was grieving, making me feel like there was kind of like a right way to do this, and I was screwing it up. I know all of this was born out of love, but my best advice to people who really want help is like what Chris has said, examine your motives. Are you there to serve or are you there to save? If you're there to serve, great. If you're there to save, probably best to take a step back. If grief is a journey, then grieving people need others to walk that journey with them, or float, as Carissa puts it, not to pull them out of it. You may be able to float with them for a few weeks or months. Floating with them can be exhausting. I know I was exhausting. I am scared of grieving people because I was scary. So, like, I know how nobody, someone could have said all the right things and I hate them, you know. And so I have a healthy fear of grieving people. Let's see. So if you may be able to float with them for a few weeks or months. Floating with them can be exhausting. Don't be afraid to tap out. Better to tap out than try to pull them out of the wreckage because you're tired. I guarantee you they're more tired. So yeah, that's that.
Okay. And what has changed with your grief as you approach year 12 as compared to right after Preston passed away?
So it's actually funny because in our runs, we've had the circle square conversation and all that kind of stuff. I'm in the circle square spot now. At the beginning, I was grieving my friend. I was grieving Preston only. I couldn't grieve anything else. I knew I was different. I couldn't grieve myself. I could only do one thing at a time. And I had to learn how to live my life and learn what my, I don't know, just keep walking, I guess. So at the beginning, it was like survival mode and how am I going to do this and just grieve Preston. That's the only person I grieved. I knew there were other things to grieve, but I didn't see them. I couldn't handle them at the moment. So eventually, I felt some semblance of life beginning to peek through. I started living a somewhat normal life. I got a job, traveled a little bit. And then all of a sudden, boom, I was grieving the loss of people I would have been in close relationship with. So Chris had talked about this. Sharon can attest to this. We had to figure out what our relationship looked like. That was super hard for me. Like, that was hard for her. I feel like sometimes the tendency is to think you can't have a relationship with that person anymore. And for some people, that might be the case. For us, we just worked really hard at figuring out how to do our relationship. I felt that way with his friends. Like, I feel really sad anytime I see someone playing hockey. It sounds so stupid. I don't like to go to hockey games. It's just too hard. So, like, I lost the friendships, like she was talking about, the person in between. You're like, this is weird. Like, we don't hang out, you know? So, understanding how that worked, and I kind of had to, like, in some ways, learn how to relate to my family differently. And yeah, so that was like second stage for me, was grieving what would have been. And yeah. And I would say the last thing that, and I would say I'm in this stage now, was grieving who I was before the accident. It's like the hardest for me to talk about because I'm in it right now, but I don't know how to explain. When Chris talked about, like, you idealize the person you were. Not everyone in this room knew me before. I walked confidently into a room. I was more extroverted. I don't know if you noticed, as people were coming in, I eventually just, like, kind of hung out up there, because that's where I feel safer now. Old Susie would have been, hey, you know, super comfortable. So I'm calling this current stage grief 2.0, the grief of who you were. I'm always trying to find out what's wrong with me so I can just fix it and be back to who I was. Like I said, I was more outgoing, extroverted, optimistic, and confident. After I lost Press and I experienced what death feels like, I guess, on the other side, I feel a little more introverted. I call it being a realist. Phil sometimes calls it being pessimistic, but I call it being a realist. So I'm always like, if you do that, this is going to happen, like, just so you know. If I can know about it, then I won't be a hurt by it. I struggle with confidence now, and I will never be able to go back to being someone who doesn't know that death can just, boom, your life has changed. Like, I can't undo that. I want to undo that sometimes. I don't want to know this. Like, I don't hope this for anyone else. Like, I know that there's something I've learned in this. So, on the plus side, because I'm working on being positive, I know that I've grown in empathy and compassion. I don't judge as often as I used to. I know more of who God is. I know of God's sovereignty because I've experienced both good and bad. I can see that I'm learning and I'm a work in progress, and joy and sadness, they can be in the same room. It doesn't have to be one or the other. You never, ever, ever get over someone. That will never happen. You only move forward with them in your heart. I've learned that, because you don't get over it. And I have full confidence that death is not goodbye, but more of a see you later. So.
So Liz is going to come back up and tell us what's next, because I don't know. Susie, can you stay up for just a second? So cool to see so many people in here who got, you know, you guys have gone through and are going through hard things, and it's cool to see. I know how hard it was for Susie. I mean, I don't know, but I think we walked through with her. It's pretty amazing to stand here today and just see how God is moving in so many people's lives, no matter what you're going through, and just to hear during the day, to be able to share that today is pretty awesome. So, what I want to say is, that's not what I want to say. She is going to be leaving the women's ministry team. So we wanted to just take a moment to thank her on behalf of all of you and all of us on the team. We're so thankful that you served with us. God's taking her and moving her on to some different things that he's always wanted to do, more worship. So we just want to say thank you for your service, and we'll miss you. I wanted to let you know we're going to now just have a moment. So our plan is we have lunch ready for you to enjoy. We have delicious Panera sandwiches. They're all labeled so you can pick what you like. I hope that we've chosen things that you will enjoy. So there's salad, drinks, everything like that. So I'd like to close this in prayer. And if you would like to be prayed for individually, a couple ladies are going to stay here and we would be more than blessed to pray for you. So we hope that this day, this will be a joyous time to just talk with one another and enjoy some fellowship after this time. And Chris, I just want to thank you so much for sharing and for your expertise, and just it was such a blessing, really, really powerful. So let me close in prayer, and like I said, if you'd like to stay here, we're going to have a couple of you stay. Otherwise, you can head to the community life room, and we'll have food for you, and thank you so much. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this morning. I thank you for all of the women here and all the places you have them right now in their life, Father God. I thank you, Lord God, that you are always with us, no matter what is going on. You are always with us. I thank you for these women. I thank you for the ways that you have used them to walk with us as we are in whatever stage, if we're grieving, they're floating along with us, Lord God. I pray that you'd help us to be people who can just float with people that are grieving, and that you would give us, and for all these things that we've learned this morning, that you would help us to utilize them to be your hands and feet to those women around us and our families. We thank you just for who you are, and just for this morning. Please bless the food, and I'll bless the rest of our day. In Jesus' name, amen. Like I said, feel free to go to the community life room. It's just around, take a left out of the store. Just follow the crowd, they'll take you there.